You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This is the last cowboy song, the end of 100-year wars. The voices sound sad as they're singing along, another piece of America's lost.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Although today we will not be talking a whole lot about either politics or science. Instead, we're once again talking about country music, focusing on the era of country stretching from World War II, sometime into the mid-1950s. We'll see how far we get, given the people who are talking, all of us have a tendency to go on, so we may end up having to stop earlier than our outline tells us to. Joining us today are, once again, Danny Anderson, Assistant Professor of English at Mount Aloysius College in Crescent, Pennsylvania. Danny, how are things back east?
Oh, things are well. We're sort of in the middle of the grind of the semester. I'm having a podcast dedicated day. I just recorded a sectarian review this morning about Dungeons and Dragons, and I just hung around and did this one this afternoon.
Spoiler alert, I guess. If you don't have to answer if you don't want to, but did you play Dungeons and Dragons growing up?
I did not. We get into this in the show. I was of the generation where the Satanic Panic was in full force, and my friends did, and I played one time, and my mom kind of got a little freaky about it, and so I never played. And looking back, I realized that's probably why I was always a lonely person. I never found my crowd, you know, and so I regret that I never played, but yeah.
Fair enough.
So playing Dungeons and Dragons would have made you cooler, is what you're saying.
Ironically so, yes.
Well, and the Game Master voice you heard in the background there, is that the right term, Danny? Game Master?
Dungeon Master.
Game Master is Captain N. If you ever watched Captain N and the Game Masters, it's a Nintendo-themed Saturday morning cartoon teamed up with Mega Man and Simon Belmont to fight Mother Brain. A totally normal thing to say.
which I never watched, and obviously have never really gotten into Dungeons and Dragons either. But the Dungeon Master, I guess, is Michael Farmer, Assistant Professor of English at Crown College in St. Bonifacius, Minnesota, and I think I got it right this time. Did I, Michael?
You did, yeah.
Awesome. I did not mess up the word saint this time around. man, the introductions are so hard.
Anti-Catholicism has really gotten out of control.
Right, so today again we're talking about a country going to war, and then the post-war developments of country music, especially as it begins to go national. Now I see that someone has written on our outline in sort of the first spot here, honky tonk to country boogie to rockabilly. So who wants to fess up to writing that and then tell us why it's on the outline?
I wrote that, and I think that's the natural progressions of country genres into the 1950s. And actually, I should have written Western swing to honky tonk to country boogie to rockabilly, because I think you can, if you listen to the hits from 1943 to 1955, you can really feel that movement. You take something like Bob Wills, I think, and then you listen to Al Dexter's Pistol Packin' Mama, one of the great country singles of the 40s, and I defy you to tell me whether that song is Western swing or this new thing called honky tonk. You know what I mean? Because it really splits the difference.
Drinking beer in a cabaret, and was I having fun? Until one night she caught me right, and now I'm on the run. Lay that pistol down, babe, lay that pistol down. Pistol packing, mama, lay that pistol down. She kicked out my windshield, she hit me over the head. She cussed and cried and said I'd lied and wished that I was dead. Lay that pistol down, babe, lay that pistol down. Pistol packing, mama, lay that pistol down.
you can keep splitting the difference well into rockabilly, and before you know it, you've called Bob Wills and Elvis Presley the same thing.
Yeah, can you just briefly tell us what each of those are? I don't think we got into those last time.
Sure. So I mean, Western swing we did talk about. That is, in a very real sense, swing music with a fiddle and sometimes a pedal steel. Honky tonk is probably what most of our listeners think of as classic country. It's what Hank Williams overwhelmingly played, Lefty Frizzell. It's full band music. It's generally upbeat. It's got a kind of 1-2 rhythm that you might call a country shuffle. Is that what you would call it, Danny?
Yeah, that works, yeah.
And you know, it's hillbilly music, but it's a little more, it's not citified exactly. A honky tonk is a dive bar where people listen to honky tonk music. Right. It's, you know, if you think Hank Williams or Lefty Frizzell, you've pretty much got it. Country boogie is a little bit harder to define. It's honky tonk with a little bit more of a swing to it, I would say. And then rockabilly is, well, everybody knows rockabilly, right? That's another thing that's very difficult to define. It is a combination of rock and roll and country, hillbilly music. So if you think of Buddy Holly, for example, That'll Be the Day, that's a rockabilly track. And I really think there's a very smooth progression through those in a way that I wasn't really prepared for when I went into my prep for this episode.
Yeah, and there's an implied seediness attached to at least some of those, right? Especially the honky tonk, right?
It's all of them.
Yeah, it's not music that you listen to in respectable places.
Yeah, and it's the music of rebellion, especially rockabilly, which is difficult for us to remember because rockabilly feels like old people music.
Right. Well, I think of people today like Marty Stewart, I mean, as sort of modern rockabilly artists, which, again, I don't know that I could necessarily draw a line between him and other contemporary artists, but he sounds like rockabilly when he's playing.
Yeah, Marty Stewart is like a very throwback act, and he would have fit in great in the 60s. He would have fit in great in the 50s. He's like very steeped in the traditions of country music, and he kind of carries them through to this day, which is why people make fun of his hair, right, and stuff like that. and he still wears the nudie suits and all that kind of thing, right? And so, so he's like a throwback act. So he's kind of idiosyncratic in a way that very few acts have been. I think he's very much his own kind of style, so he is hard to trace in a line.
Yeah, and I like the that's a good description, Michael, of sort of what leads into the country music of the 50s, especially the music of Ernest Tubb and Roy Acuff, and then you put Eddie Arnold on there. He's not exactly in those streams, right? Is that a
Well, and I'm not 100% sure. I would say that Ernest Tubb, I suppose, is honky tonk, and maybe Roy Acuff too. But they're really a few years before that particular genre really takes off, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. I think they're kind of they're sort of the establishment that Hank Williams challenges, sort of, with honky tonk.
Yeah,
that's the way I think of them. Yeah.
And they've got something in common. It's not like it's a million miles away, but I. Those are not the guys I think of when I think of honky tonk. Although something like Ernest Tubb's "I'm Walking the Floor Over You," that wouldn't take much to make it a honky tonk song. Let me put it that way.
I'm walking the floor over you. I can't sleep a wink, that is true. I'm hoping and I'm praying as my heart breaks right in two. Walking the floor over you. You left me and you went away. You said that you'd be back in just a day. You've broken your promise and you left me here alone. I don't know why you did, dear, but I do know that you're gone. I'm walking the floor.
Well, and if there's some sort of stumbling for terms and identifications here, all of these people and all of these styles of music are being played in the same places.
Yes, right?
They're all, if they're on the radio, they're on the Hayride programs and they're on the barn dance programs and they're on the big national programs. If they are And once TV comes around, which is a big moment that we'll get to later, but once TV comes around, they're all on the Grand Ole Opry. Grand Ole Opry, sorry listeners,
yes.
I apologize.
Yes, I think that's accurate. Hank Williams has a checkered history with the Grand Ole Opry, doesn't he? Didn't he get kicked off?
Yeah, because of alcoholism. Not because of music style, but
sure, sure, yeah.
Couldn't stay sober.
Well, and one thing that's, and we're jumping all over the place, but who cares, right? One of the things that's great about Hank Williams is whatever rebellion is there in him, there's also a really heavy traditionalist streak, such that, I mean, some of what he's playing could have been 15 years before him. And he doesn't seem to recognize any kind of tension there, which is one thing that's great about him, among about 400 other things. Hank Williams is the best.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. We are jumping all over the place, and I'll try to straighten this out in editing. No, it's my fault. I should have had a tighter outline there. I do want to start. So we have some terms that we've kind of outlined, and then talked about how it's you can't really draw lines between these terms. In terms of chronology, we're starting today with World War II, and we were talking before the show about how country it's not really a genre we associate with. Well, war in general, maybe, but especially with World War II. I mean, we could talk about Toby Keith in the 21st century in Iraq and Afghanistan, but I mean, that's 60, 70 years down the road. Why is it that country, at least in our minds, we don't associate it with going to fight the Germans or the Japanese or the Italians? Why does it seem to stay above that? It doesn't completely, right? There is war music on kind of both sides of war is bad and here's the cost of it, and war is necessary and we're going to kick their rears, but that's not the thought most of us have first when we think of 1940s country, right? Why is that? Is there something in the bones of country? Is it because these were all poor people and they're all fighting instead of singing? I mean, what's the deal here?
Well, I mean, Michael, you said something about it not being a very political genre, like in the pregame talk here.
At the time,
right? And I think that there's some material reasons for that. I think that you have, when the record companies start becoming more precise with their demographics, the names of these genres, you know, race records just becomes R&B, and hillbilly records becomes country music. There's a point at which the stuff that's being, like the folk music that we call today, is separated from country music, so people
it's like 1945. I mean, the charts are called the folk charts up until I think 45. And one thing that's interesting is the race records and the hillbilly records are both on the folk charts.
Yeah.
So Al Dexter gets replaced on the charts with Bing Crosby, who gets replaced on the charts with Louis Jordan.
Yeah.
Which is a really weird thing if you're thinking of the folk charts as the country charts.
Exactly, right? And so what we know as folk music, which is much more political, I mean, the opening of your show, right, is Woody Guthrie, right? And so, but that becomes like a separate genre. And so there, that energy, that approach to music is just kind of weeded out, from the genre because of kind of material reasons, having to do with the marketing of records, I think, partially. And I think there's a more kind of conservative audience left when you weed that out, and they're not looking. It's the shut up and play kind of crowd. I don't know how to say it other than that, right? They're sort of looking for the traditions, and they're not looking to be cutting edge or be thought provoking in many ways. And in ways the way are, they're very pro America, go Yankees, right? You know, and that sort of thing. Right?
Well, not Yankees, but
yeah. Excuse me. Yes.
The other thing is, how political is jazz music at the time? I mean, the pop that's going on in the northern states, I'm not sure, is a whole lot more political than the country going on in the southern states. I know that Bing Crosby, for example, sings a patriotic song every now and then on his radio show, but it seems to me that most of the traditional pop and vocal jazz music from that era is also not really about the war.
I don't know enough about jazz to be able to.
Gosh, because yeah, all I can picture are GIs dancing to Benny Goodman, right?
Right. So which is instrumental.
It is, right. Yeah, that's true. And so I guess that's a good point. Yeah, the instrumental nature of it maybe has something to do with it. I mean, you do have things like Strange Fruit and, mm-hmm. But that's a different kind of politics, I guess, we're talking about.
And I mean, there are some, right. And I couldn't come up with one off the top of my head right now, but there are some. But my impression, without having done any kind of research, of course, is that it wasn't really much more political than country music. And I think that probably people didn't think of pop music as being art and thus didn't really think of it as having an important message. I think that happens once folk begins to make its influence known on pop music.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting because movies, you know, film is a much newer medium, but it's already being used explicitly for propaganda purposes, right? I mean, the government's cranking out films. Frank Capra, if you guys haven't seen this, Frank Capra's World War II documentary is fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, it'll make you want to go fight Nazis. I mean, it's really well done.
Alfred Hitchcock did some.
Yeah.
And just a little chance for a plug to the Christian Humanist podcast crossover.
Although this will probably air after that. So.
Yeah.
go back and listen.
Can you believe what Gilmore said?
I can't. I'm sure it was terrible.
Oh yeah, especially on that podcast. He's on the feminist one, right? Is what he's slotted for.
I don't even know.
I don't remember.
Yeah, so I guess I'll go back to the genre argument and say that they're not so much into the war in country, because at this point whatever there is that kind of precedes country music is still focused on a specific part of the country. We're not yet to that national stage, which I think really comes when we get to the 50s. Television, the corporations, and especially Hank Williams. But you guys are free to push back on that. I think their substance, the stuff they're singing about, is still regional, especially to the South and to the Southwest.
And they are marketed that way. If you look at the 45s, Eddie Arnold, who I know we'll talk about in a little while, is called the Singing Tennessee Plowboy. Hank Williams has a backing group called the Rambling Cowboys or the Singing Cowboys. They all have band names like that locate them geographically in the South and Southwest.
Yeah. Yeah, and whereas movies are a kind of universal, like the mass market art,
sure.
These are still like being targeted at very specific demographics between, you know, R&B and country, and increasingly so. And so it doesn't have it's the utility for propaganda, I suppose, that a movie might.
Right. Well, and it has to, just because the production costs are so much higher, right? You have to market it at the whole nation. With that said, there is some music. Do we want to do some quick recommendations for World War II music before we move on to, some of the big names from this era?
Yeah, are you talking about music that is specifically about World War II, or just music that was released during World War II?
Music that is specifically about World War II.
Okay. Well, the one we talked about before the show is the only one I know, Red Foley's Smoke on the Water.
Be a sad day coming for the foes of all mankind. They must answer to the people, and it's trouble in their mind. Everybody who must fear them will rejoice on that great day, when the powers of dictators shall be taken all away. There'll be smoke on the water, on the land and the sea, when our army and navy overtakes the enemy. There'll be smoke on the mountains where the heathen gods stay, and the sun that is rising will go down on that day. For there is a great destroyer made of fire and flesh and steel, rolling toward the foes of freedom. They'll go down beneath its wheels. There'll be nothing left but vultures to inhabit all that land, when our modern ships and bombers make a graveyard of Japan. There'll be smoke on the water, on the land and the sea.
Yeah.
Which is not the source of the Deep Purple song, as far as I know.
It's got a terrible riff. And it's really I was struck by the lyrics. The lyrics are really apocalyptic and dark, and so it combines this "Yay America" with this almost like America is this war machine that will crush you. So it doesn't approach American exceptionalism as anything other than just kind of God's hammer, like a brute force. And so it's a really strange pro-war song, really.
Well, it's not strange for country music, though, right? That could be a Toby Keith song.
that's totally true.
You have pissed us off, and we are coming for you, and we're going to plant our boot in your ear. A couple that I found that are, listener, take this all with a grain of salt and remember it's from the 40s and we were fighting people of different ethnicities. There's a song called 1942 Turkey in the Straw, which tells you what the theme is. But it's about, Hitler and what's going to happen to him by Carson Robinson.
Adolf Hitler grabbed the tail. He hung right on with tooth and nail. Then he saw what he had and he began to swear. On the end of that tail was a Russian bear. The old bear growled and started in to shake. Adolf knew he'd made a mistake. He tried to hang on, then he tried to let go. Now they have a new dance called Hitler in the Snow. I saw Mussolini sitting on a log, all puffed up like a great big frog. I sneaked up close and stuck him with a wire. It just went like an old flat tire. I took his hide and I hung it on a tree. The tree said, "Hey, don't do that to me." So I took it on home to my mother-in-law. She threw me outside with the turkey in the straw.
Probably the biggest hit to come out of country music in the 1940s is a song by Elton Britt called "There's a Star-Spangled Banner Waving Somewhere."
There's a star-spangled banner waving somewhere in a distant land so many miles away. Only Uncle Sam's great heroes get to go there, where I wish that I could also live someday. I'd see Lincoln, Custer, Washington, and Perry, Nathan Hale and Colin Kelly too. There's a star-spangled banner waving somewhere, waving o'er the land of heroes brave and true.
And it's about how excited this young kid from rural America is to join the military and get to go see all of the places that all of the great American heroes have been.
And get his brains blown out where so many brains have been blown out before.
In the subtext, yes. Tex Ritter, I think, has a couple songs. The Deck of Cards song, which I find just loathsome, is a World War II song. And then there's a handful of songs about the loss of war. So one called Gold Star in the Window, and one called Teardrop Falling in the Snow, are about the cost of war and the loss of war, and how the people back home deal with the knowledge that the people they sent off are never coming back. So we'll put links to all these up in the show.
So to return to the Tex Ritter song, I don't know that song. What do you find so loathsome about it?
Oh, it's I should have re-listened to the whole thing. So the premise is this guy, it's like Sunday morning and they're at church or chapel or whatever on the front. And this, one guy takes out a Bible and one guy takes out a prayer book. And this other guy, all he has is a deck of cards. So he takes out his deck of cards and like deals them out on the ground. And his sergeant comes by and starts yelling at him for playing cards on during the chapel service. And he's like, "Well, the chapel, these cards are my prayer book. And the ace reminds me that there's one God. And the king reminds me that God is king." And I mean, it's just this schmaltzy.
"You see, sir, when I look at the ace in my deck of cards, it reminds me there is but one God. The deuce tells me that the Bible is divided into two parts, the Old and the New Testaments. When I see the tray, I think of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. And when I look at the four, I think of the four great evangelists who preach the gospel. There were Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. When I see the five, it reminds me of the five wise virgins who trimmed their lamps. There were 10 of them. 5 were wise and were saved. 5 were foolish and were shut out. When I look at the 6, I know that in 6 days, God made this great heaven and earth.
Does the queen remind him of our mother?
Yes, it does, I believe, actually. The queen of heaven and the jack is the devil. I don't remember all of them, but there's something for each number and each.
I mean, how many non-Christian country or Christmas country songs could possibly mention the Virgin Mary? That's amazing.
I might be misremembering that, but I'm pretty sure that's in there.
Tex Ritter, for our listeners who don't know, is indeed John Ritter's father.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Doesn't that make it even weirder? He had a number of hits, probably most famously Blood on the Saddle. He has a very cartoonish, deep voice.
Yeah, very cowboy, singing cowboy kind of style, right? And so, which made Three's Company all the more shocking to people of my parents' generation. So to see Tex Ritter's son do that, those kinds of things, right?
So. Wear those tiny shorts. Tex Ritter never would have worn tiny shorts.
I don't know, man. I mean, he's saying Deck of Cards, so.
Tex Ritter will always be Big Al from the Country Bear Jamboree to me. That's my personal Tex Ritter.
Fair enough. Well, in this time period, aside from the war, the big names, Ernest Tubb, Roy Acuff, and Eddie Arnold. And Michael, you insisted that we talk about Eddie Arnold, so why don't you kick us off?
Eddie Arnold is a name I had heard, but until to prepare for this, I went and downloaded every number one country song from the 40s and 50s, which isn't as expensive as it sounds because most of them are available for free from archive.org. Eddie Arnold has just a massive number of hits in the late 1940s. And in fact, in 1947, there are only 4 weeks in the entire year that he is not topping the country charts. And it's actually with a number of different songs. So I think he has 5 or 6 different singles hit number one in 1947, and basically nobody else has a number one. So he's this enormous presence in popular country music in the 1940s, and not entirely forgotten, but certainly not held up the way other people from that era are held up. Hank Williams, certainly. Lefty Frizzell, certainly. But even someone like Webb Pierce, who has far fewer singles than Eddie Arnold, is much more beloved, I think.
Yeah, the country station I grew up listening to was a classic country station, which at the time meant sort of everything before 1985. The only Eddie Arnold song I remember from that was Cattle Call.
That's much later.
Right. Yeah, it's from like, well, I want to say he wrote it and recorded it in like the mid 40s, but the one that they played was not the mid 40s version.
Gotcha.
Something he re-recorded in the late 50s, early 60s.
I listened to probably 20 Eddie Arnold songs, and I'm not sure I could name one. I listened to them multiple times each. They're all, I don't think any of them are that good. I think he's kind of a milquetoast vocalist. He doesn't have a lot of quality to his voice the way Hank Williams does or Al Dexter. But he was a huge bestseller in country music, and I think in some ways you can look at his music and see the beginnings of country pop because a lot of the edges are smoothed off.
Yeah, and that's a good transition into Roy Acuff, but before we do that, I want to see if there's anything else on Eddie Arnold.
I remember, wasn't Make the World Go Away? Was that him or is that somebody else? When I think of Eddie Arnold, I think of somebody from the kind of high era of like country pop, right? When it was the Nashville sound proper and he was sort of a high priest of that. Maybe I'm confusing him with somebody else. I don't know. Using him with Charlie Rich for some reason, you've hit on something though with Eddie Arnold as being kind of a general act. He is he's a crossover, right? He's one of the first people who is a country artist who is also kind of marketable to people who aren't hillbillies, right?
Right.
So, yeah, he's a little bit more respectable.
Yeah.
Google tells me that Eddie Arnold sang that song, but that the person who made it popular was Elvis.
Oh, okay.
Which I mean, of course, talk about cross like a crossover voice, you know. The guy who so to sort of take that side and run with it, the guy who popularizes music as country music, as much as it gets popular in the 40s, which again is still in a very limited sense, is Roy Acuff, and in some ways he is a compliment and a contrast to Eddie Arnold, right? On the one hand, he is singing kind of newer stuff. He's singing things that are relevant to what's going on at the time. It's not exactly just hillbilly music anymore, but it is still done in that hillbilly style, right? It's still kind of the mournful voice. It still sounds like it's coming out of the mountains. And apparently he resisted adding electric instruments just as long as the radio and TV companies would let him. Like he fought that tooth and nail until the very end, which again just added to sort of that appeal of this is something distinct from other styles of music out there, even though apparently he had to give up on some of that eventually. So if Eddie Arnold is kind of drawing country music closer to pop, Roy Acuff is standing on the line between the two and saying, no, we're doing something else, even if that's not intentionally what he was doing. As far as I can tell, he just liked the other kind of music. He liked what he liked, and he wasn't going to play anything else. I don't want to spend too much time on Roy Acuff, but he is the person, from what I understand, who breaks country really into the beginnings of the national consciousness. He's the person who, again, I don't want to promote him too much, but the person who makes people aware that there is a specific kind of music that's country music, even if they don't necessarily know his name. And the vehicle of this is the Grand Ole Opry. Right?
Yeah.
The vehicle of this is this show that's in Tennessee that through reasons that I don't really understand manages to swamp all of the other similar radio shows out there and rise to sort of prominence to the point where it's the show that everyone tries to pick up and carry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he has this kind of very Carter Family-ish high-pitched tenor voice, right? That sounds like almost bluegrass, right? And so he is, I think, a super important figure, because when I was growing up, he was still very old but alive, and so he would always get carted out on stage by newer acts who were paying homage to the tradition, right? So, for many decades after his prime, he was kind of seen as this symbol of country music, I think, right? And so he's, and largely, I think, because of the association with Grand Ole Opry, for sure. Which we'll talk about in a little bit, I think, more length.
Yeah, he also had a World War II song, by the way, called Cowards Over Pearl Harbor.
Amazing.
Oh, wow.
his other big legacy, of course, is the publishing company Acuff Rose.
Right.
And Fred Rose is another songwriter and producer, probably best known for writing Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain.
Mm.
Right. He and Acuff and Hank Williams are the first three inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. Like they're the original guys recognized by the industry. Anything else on Acuff? Otherwise, there's someone else we were going to talk about. Ernest Tubb. I know very little about Ernest Tubb, so if you guys have anything you want to say.
Again, I point to Cocaine and Rhinestones, the Tyler Mahan Co. podcast. His first episode is on Ernest Tubb trying to kill somebody.
Ernest somebody who deserved it.
Ernest Tubb's big hit was Walking the Floor Over You, which he sings in a deep baritone, deep resonant baritone voice. He also did, this might be the first ever Christmas version of a popular song called I'm Walking the Floors This Christmas.
Right.
So you can see how important that song was to him. I don't love him. I find his delivery stilted, but it's hard to deny I'm Walking the Floor Over You at the very least. What do you think of him, Danny?
Well, I think, I mean, again, almost like Acuff, he's as important for what he represents institutionally than as he is for his music. And so like the Ernest Tubb Record Shop was, it still exists. And when I went to Nashville for the first time in the 80s, it's much different than it is now. It's much more still like not a big metropolitan city yet. It still feels like a small provincial town. And Ernest Tubb Record Shop is like stands out as like this mecca place. Now it's kind of like pushed off into the sides, but it's this place that kind of begins to establish the Nashville as the center of country music, which up until the 40s, I mean, when the 40s begin, there is no like place that country music is located in. We talked in the last episode about how it's kind of distributed in different regions. And starting in the 40s, Nashville kind of develops into that place. And partially the Grand Ole Opry is a big part of that. Ernest Tubb Record Shop is a big part of that, but also just the fact that there's so many session musicians there that it just became a convenient place. Chet Atkins, I think, is the famous one that people point to.
Right.
That it just became this sort of mecca for the industry to actually plant itself there, and then all of country music sort of coalesces around this single geographic location. And so, I think Ernest Tubb and Roy Acuff are great people to talk about in lead up to that development.
Right. All of which comes together in the late 40s, early 1950s, and in some ways in the person of Hank Williams, right? I mean, he is sort of the rope that ties these three threads bound together. Really the early 1950s is when we see, I think, country begin to truly step out as a distinct genre, even as it's still related to other genres. But just as an example of this, by May of 1951, the song The Tennessee Waltz had become the biggest selling hit in pop music history up until that point.
But the Patti Page version or somebody else's?
The Patti Page version.
That's such a great song and such a great version, but you want to talk about the Nashville sound. Other than her southern accent and the fact that Tennessee is in the title, that's not a country song at all.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, right. I mean, it is a country. It's about Tennessee, for crying out loud. You know, it's not the New York City.
But there's nothing in the instrumentation that connects it to 1940s country music at all.
Right.
I was dancing with my darling to the Tennessee Waltz. When an old friend I happened to see, I introduced her to my loved one, and while they were dancing, my friend stole my sweetheart from me. I remember the night and the tear Tennessee Waltz. Now I know just how much I have lost. Yes, I lost my little darling the night they were playing the beautiful Tennessee Waltz.
Right, and that's where we see that sort of blending of genres too, right? Where they're aware of stuff that's going on other places, but you would never listen to that and confuse it with Buddy Holly or Chuck Berry or anything that's going on in the other genres at the time. So let's maybe talk about that transition a little bit, and I think there are kind of three aspects to this, three things that come together: the corporate world that's beginning to develop, the rise of television, right? So this is when people begin to associate visual images with country music beyond just whatever happens to be on the album cover, right? This is when you really have the cowboy as set in stone as this is what country music is. From this point on, if you're a country musician, you got to wear a cowboy hat and boots at some point, even if you've never been on a ranch in your life. Where was I going? The three things, right? The commercialization, the television, the kind of final or final question mark split with rock. And let's just take each of these one at a time. Danny, can you talk to us about country music going corporate?
Yeah, so one thing that I kind of learned in doing some research about this is that it in the 40s, going back just a little bit, you have this kind of proliferation of new talent into country music that's kind of facilitated by this strike. There's the American Federation of Musicians had a strike between 1942 and 1944, and basically they prohibited any kind of union member for recording for any of the big publishing companies. With some exceptions, they were allowed to do things like records that were shipped overseas to soldiers and that kind of thing. There were some exceptions to this, but largely there was this kind of battle over royalties, and there was this strike amongst musicians. And that kind of led to the rise of a bunch of like the small labels, like the sort of independent labels of country music. And those independent labels then became entryways into the business for acts that didn't necessarily have access to the big labels, right? And so they got themselves established in these small labels, and then once they were famous, they got signed on to the bigger label. So it was a way to inject a bunch of talent into the industry as it's developing, right? So in the 40s, that's starting to happen, and you get with – I think Eddie Arnold is a good place to talk about this – desire to sell records to as many people as possible. We need to kind of, I mean, it's still a niche audience, but it's also, there's an economic imperative to broaden that niche as widely as possible. Eddie Arnold's smoothness is one aspect of that. And so, I think that I was doing a little bit of research, and a guy named Ken Nelson is a very important producer and for a couple of reasons. He's actually instrumental in creating the original Nashville sound that we're about to talk about, this kind of corporatization of style. And also, ironically, its antithesis later on, the Bakersfield sound. He's very important in producing Buck Owens and Merle Haggard and folks. And so he's a really kind of a titanic figure when you think about his influence on country music. But he actually can I talk about Hank Thompson's Wild Side of Life? It's like, Is this a good moment to talk about?
That's a great moment to talk about that.
Okay, because I feel like there's two really completely different ways in which that song is super instructive in figuring out the milieu of this time. I'm a bear of very little brain, and so I do much business with the sectarian review. We find a little small thing to kind of look closely, so I don't that instead of the big philosophical question. So here's a small little song that I think illustrates a bunch of very important things.
You wouldn't read my letter if I wrote you. You asked me not to call you on the phone, but there's something I'm wanting to tell you, so I wrote it in the words of this song. I didn't know.
And so that song is one of Ken Nelson's kind of big achievements, starting to develop Nashville sound. You've got this kind of orchestration, you've got this choral element that comes along with it, and so that song kind of leads, I guess the apotheosis of this, from what I've read, is Ferlin Husky's song Gone, and mm-hmm. That's a really heavily produced song where you have chorals and harmonies, and there's a famous soprano singing in the background, use of echo and all sorts of heavily orchestrated things that begin to sound a little bit like Bing or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've got that way. Thompson is sort of the figure in which that thing starts to develop.
Since you've gone, the moon, the sun, the stars in the sky, know the reason why I cry. Love divine once was mine, now you've gone. Since you've gone, my heart, my lips, my tear-dimmed eyes, a lonely soul within me cries. I acted smart, broke your heart, now you've gone.
That song, Wild Side of Life, interestingly enough, Thompson's song steals its melody from Roy Acuff's Great Speckled Bird, which, interestingly enough, borrowed that melody from a Carter Family song, which I can't remember the name of right off the top of my head. So you've got this really interesting lineage of the development of country music in this one song. And so Wild Side of Life is a really interesting kind of moment to trace the development of country music all the way back from the Carter Family, pointing forward to this kind of high Nashville sound. It's also really interesting because it becomes the source for Kitty Wells' really truly classic song, It Wasn't God Who Made Honky Tonk Angels, which is an answer song. It's a direct response to the kind of sexist argument that Wild Side of Life is making.
Wild Side of Life is just ridiculously sexist, even for the 50s.
Yeah. Sure.
Night, the jukebox playing the tune about the wild side of life. As I listen to the words you are saying, it brings memories when I was a trusted wife. It wasn't God who made honky-tonk angels, as you said in the words of your song. Too many times married men think they're still single. That has caused many a good girl to go wrong.
And so Kitty Wells has really the first female solo hit in country music with this song, and it far eclipses the thing that she's answering back to, and it copies the melody of Wild Side of Life. It's the same melody again for the fourth time now we've heard it. But it's really a super important moment because it's like a feminist injection of rejection of kind of the paternalistic approach of country music, and she paved the way for your Loretta Lynns and your Dolly Partons and everybody who came beyond her. Really is because of Kitty Wells singing the song that was banned at the time on NBC radio, that wasn't allowed to be played at the Grand Ole Opry, and so
Wait, why was it banned? Just because it was pro-woman? I mean, there's nothing the slightest bit offensive in that song.
It was at the time challenged sort of sexual mores. I mean, this was a woman's place. She's challenging the woman's place in the social hierarchy. And so, and she was married, so she was allowed to kind of tour. Like, a lot of female acts weren't allowed to tour because it was unseemly for them with men, but she was married, so it was okay. But but that song was super challenging because it was a woman sticking up. I mean, it was strictly because it was a woman sticking up for herself, and so it was actually banned for a time. But now it's, I mean, recognized as an essential country music song.
Well, it's weird because the morality in that song is much more conservative than the morality in The Wild Side of Life.
Exactly.
I mean, I shouldn't be surprised. I understand it's sexism, but I would like to know how they justified it, given that her song is so much more conservative than his.
Yeah, well, I guess that shows you about the conservatism that was prevalent at the time. It was kind of a false one that was rather sexist at its core, right?
Not so, that that's still a problem.
Yeah, now we've totally gotten over that. Yeah, thank God. So
Kenny Wells is a boss. And everybody should go listen to It Wasn't God Who Made Honky Tonk Angels. There's also a great Laura Cantrell song called Kitty Wells Dresses in tribute to her.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and so, yeah, she's a hugely important figure. And so I just wanted to bring up the example of Thompson, one song, because I think you see two major shifts happening in country music at that one little fulcrum point in its history. And so I think that when you're talking about the development of the corporatization of it, you see that end of it, but also you see some kind of ideological expansion going on at that same moment. And it's really kind of cool to look into. There's a great little NPR package about it if you can get on the internet. It's great.
Well, and it's also, like, this is also the point when it actually becomes sort of a full-fledged industry, right? I mean, mm-hmm. this is when, you know, the production of, I don't remember exactly what, like, whether it's 50 or 51 or 49, but it's somewhere in here that production companies begin to sell more records than they do sheet music. Mm. Like there's this point when people are now consuming rather than participating in terms of what they're purchasing, and it's also post-war, so there are now the resources available to begin producing more records, to begin marketing stuff. We don't have the war restrictions on material usage, and of course the mass media, right? So television is going to be another big part of the marketing side of this. Not to go sort of full communist here, but the idea that we're using media to convince people that they need things or should be listening to things, even if they don't actually need them or maybe shouldn't be listening to them, that's now there in full force, right? I mean, once television begins to replace radio as the dominant means of communication, country gets much more pigeonholed, I guess. It becomes much more of its own genre, again, because of that visual expectation, right? And the corporations obviously maximize their profits on that, as you would expect them to do. And whether that's good or bad, we could argue, but they take that and run with it.
What are some of the country music TV shows from the 50s?
Oh, well, Roy Acuff, of course, I forget if he was still on the Grand Ole Opry at this point, but or not. I have a list of them. Let me just a second on that.
I only know Hee Haw, which is of course much later.
Yeah.
I know the ones in the 60s more.
The Johnny Cash show.
Yeah, Buck Owens has his own thing.
Buck Owens is Hee Haw, isn't he?
I thought he had his own. Maybe I'm wrong. I know he
Porter
is.
Porter Wagner has had his own show, but that's also 60s.
That's later. Cornbread Matinee.
Cornbread Matinee.
Louisiana Hayride.
But these titles really offensively play up the hillbilly thing, don't they? Louisiana Hayride. What was it? Cornpone Matinee?
Which, again, some of these might have been radio.
But still,
started as radio shows.
As it becomes commercial, it becomes gimmicky.
I remember seeing reruns of some show that took place in a barn, and the people were standing around. I think Hams sing in a barn, and I do not know the name of the show, but when I was a kid, I remember this being on television in reruns and watching this. And so maybe my memory is faulty, but.
So I used to watch Hee Haw reruns growing up under duress at the insistence of my dad. But that was the common thing we watched.
I was made to watch Lawrence Welk at my grandmother's house.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah,
give me Hee Haw.
Yeah, so the rise of television creates this image of what a country music singer is, and associates that image with a specific kind of sound, which again begins, I think, to draw a much more solid line between country music and, as you were talking about earlier, Danny, folk music, but also between country music and rock and roll. That's also developing at the same time. Well, Michael, can you talk to us about the split with rock? When we, or if it is a split with rock, feel free to push back against that.
Well, I mean, I would say it's a split. We talked a little bit about rockabilly and how closely related rockabilly is to country music, and in some ways, not in some ways, rockabilly is the combination of rock and roll, which is, at least to begin with, a black art form, and country music. So at first, what you've got with rockabilly is white guys doing impressions of Chuck Berry or whoever, and not being able to get rid of their country roots. So it is distinct, although very closely related. My guess is eventually what happens is a style of music that can be closely paralleled with country music, a style of rock that can be closely paralleled with country music, comes into fashion. And so the split happens. Country music goes in the directions it goes, and rock moves into, you know, British invasion or psychedelic or what have you, and then eventually back around to country rock. So any kind of split you get is always temporary because things come back together. We talked in the last episode about how we should have talked about how nowadays hip hop has a sizable influence on country music. But I do think they come very closely together for 5 or 6 years in the 50s and then split apart again. I mean, Elvis had a number of number one hits on the country charts, and they're the same number one hits he had on the pop charts. It's, you know, it's Don't Be Cruel, it's Heartbreak Hotel, it's stuff that does not instantly read as country music to me.
Yeah, and I sort of agree with that. I read something about how, you know, 10 years earlier or 10 years later, Buddy Holly would have fit in perfectly well as a country artist. But at the moment that he was singing, there was this different genre that he could go into, right? And so that also, I think, necessitated, if you will, the way in which the studio becomes a little bit, or the studio system in Nashville becomes a little bit more kind of milquetoast, and you get these orchestrated kind of general audience versions of country music that become popular in the 50s. And so, yeah, your Eddie Arnolds and all those kinds of folks really kind of take the hold of the genre in the 50s because it's defending itself against rock music. Right. And so rock and roll, and you know, it's Jerry Lee is making explicitly country later on, right? And
well, not even later on. The B-side to Great Balls of Fire is You Win Again, which is a Hank Williams tune.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, there is some like real weird intersections there, but for sales reasons, for generic reasons, they're just sort of separated out.
I think part of it is a rebellion issue. I think even in the 50s, country music is pretty straight-laced, yeah. Hank Williams notwithstanding. And so you get somebody like Jerry Lee Lewis blowing in. Do you know what I mean? Can you imagine him on the stage of the Grand Ole Opry?
Not more than once.
Yeah, right. So I think part of it is created by marketing, and part of it is a real difference in image. But then you've got somebody like Johnny Cash, who really does have a foot in both worlds.
Yeah. Yeah, and remember, Waylon Jennings was touring with Buddy Holly when he died, right? And
so yeah, he was the bass player.
Yeah.
And yeah, I already talked about Jerry Lee Lewis, but I can't stress enough, Jerry Lee Lewis very easily could have been considered a country artist. Mm-hmm. He was not doing anything in terms of the music that wouldn't have been more or less country. Just like I said, his first the B-side to his big rock single was You Win Again, and then, you know, he did Crazy Arms. I think the same year Ray Price did Crazy Arms, so. If you want to think of Jerry Lee Lewis as a country singer, I don't see any problem with that. He's at least as much a country singer as Johnny Cash is.
And yet you wouldn't think of Hank Williams as a rock singer.
No, but part of that is that rock didn't exist as a category till after he died. But I think you could look at a song like I'm a Long Gone Daddy or Mind Your Own Business, and those are rock songs at least as much as Rock of 88 is. Move it on over. The kind of Western swing influenced Hank Williams. I mean, if he'd lived another 5 years, I'm sure he would have done rock music.
Right. Yeah, if he'd managed to stay sober or kept drinking, I guess. I don't know which way you have to go to do rock.
If he'd stayed right. Alive.
And that's probably a good place. We've talked about him a bit. Hank Williams is, again, the first nationally recognized country music performer. Right. Jimmy Rogers was the most well-known performer of his time, but to say he was the most well-known was not really to say anything in the early 1930s. We didn't have a mass culture in that sense yet, for various reasons. Same thing with Roy Acuff. Again, he's most well-known. Eddie Arnold, again, same deal. Hank Williams is the guy who people who are listening to music in America, regardless of what part of the country they're in, they're going to know who Hank Williams is.
Yeah, I was gonna ask if maybe Al Dexter, because Bing Crosby covered Pistol Pack and Mama, but yeah, certainly if you asked around today, Hank Williams is the oldest country singer that you can count on everybody having heard of.
Well, and I would even say at the time, right? If you did, they didn't have national polls in the same way then. But if you did a poll of people from all of the different parts of the country over. Name country singers. The first person that's going to show up on polls from each part of the country is going to be Hank Williams, right? There is no one before that.
Yeah, that may be true.
The famous people before him were famous in very, very limited circles. Now that may be true of everyone. Maybe that's true in jazz too, right? If you're from New York, you know Harlem jazz, and you don't know people from St. Louis or New Orleans. I don't know enough about those other genres to speak to that. But Williams is the first person, at least in country, who becomes sort of nationally known. And again, that reinforces this image of country music as a specific kind of music with specific images specific ideas and specific sounds associated with it, even if those sounds are hard to discriminate from other places, from other kinds of music. There are certainly other people who are important at the time. Lefty Frizzell, right? This is kind of his big moment, one of his big moments. He makes a comeback later. We've already talked about Kitty Wells and Patti Page would be some other people who are doing very well at the time, but Williams is certainly the king. What do you guys think about Hank Williams? And I don't mean just in sort of the professional sense, like, do you like his music?
Yeah, I do. And I spent a lot of time this week trying to figure out why he's so good. Which is not an easy question to answer, but I do have a few answers. Number one reason we remember him is that he lived what we associate with the rock star lifestyle. So he is addicted to morphine. He's addicted to alcohol. He gets kicked out of the Grand Ole Opry. He dies in the back of a car on New Year's Eve, right. I think, of all things. So I think you can't underestimate the mythology of Hank Williams. He wrote most of his own songs in an era where that wasn't all that common. It was not unheard of. Other people did it. But he did it to a much greater degree than other country music stars did. I think he has a really remarkable voice. He has a voice that really... carries his pain in a way that is not ostentatious. I think he does a number of genres, so his songs don't all sound the same, even though within each genre they're fairly formulaic. And then to get at something you were saying last time, I think you got it from Malcolm Gladwell, this notion that country music is specific and sincere. You know Hank Williams by listening to his songs. You know what he's been through. You know what his marriage was like. You know all these different things, and he expresses it in a way that is very straightforward but deep at the same time. So I really think nobody needs me to say this, but he's a remarkable singer-songwriter, country star.
Yeah, and I think he sets that standard for like the artist, right? He sort of embodies the artist and that transcends commercialism. You can imagine Hank Williams singing his songs out of need just to express himself, whether there's an industry to pay him or not. Right. And so, yeah, there seems to be something kind of, authentic. I hate that again, that's not the right word that I'm looking for, but there seems to be something that's truly passionate about him. And he's doing this for reasons that kind of, transcend money. Now, obviously, he wasn't. He was doing this for money as well. But he had the way he expressed his art. It did feel like real, right, to him, and it felt like expressive. And I think he sets the template for what we would come to, the sort of romantic hero of a tragic artist, right? And that's something that we're always going to be sort of attracted to. But part of that is because of the quality of his music too. The writing is just, I'm so lonesome I could cry. That's just great poetry.
But very simple, right? There's nothing complex about it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It isn't. There's nothing to decode, right? It's just he's picking specific images and sounds to reference that actually emotional pick that you can just with, and he has this kind of yodeling, crooning voice that it sounds like he's mourning, right? And so he would fit in any kinds of genre. I could imagine him being a punk singer, as his son is, right? His grandson, Hank III, is kind of falling that mode. He's half punk and half country, and then I think there's something very kind of translatable about him. He's so sort of specifically talented. He's a giant.
Yeah, and I don't know that I appreciated his talent as a vocalist until I prepped for this show. I'd always liked Hank Williams. I had a collection of his singles and all that, but listening to his version of "You Win Again" next to Johnny Cash's and next to Jerry Lee Lewis, you really see what a masterful singer he is, because both of those guys kind of well known as vocalists, and his version blows theirs out of the water. It's not even close.
Right, and I want to get back to Johnny Cash the next time we record one of these, because I think Hank Williams is a good place to end. But I would Hank Williams, you guys are actually echoing Williams himself, so we got a Hank Williams quote here. Someone asked him why he thought country music was so successful, and his answer was, it can be explained in just one word: sincerity. When a hillbilly sings a crazy song, he feels crazy. When he sings "I Laid My Mother Away," he sees her laying right there in the coffin. He sings more sincere than most entertainers, because the hillbilly was raised rougher than most entertainers. You got to know a lot about hard work. You've got to have smelt a lot of mule manure before you can sing like a hillbilly. The people who has been raised something like the way a hillbilly has knows what he is singing about and appreciates it. I would add in... And this sort of goes back to the beginning of why country didn't really why we don't associate country music with war music, either before, you know, for it or against it, is I think one of the unique aspects of country is its focus on the private rather than on social issues. And here's maybe a place where it separates further out from folk music. But the themes in general of country music are things that affect me personally, right? My individual life, rather than
mind your own business. A great Hank Williams song,
right? Or my heart is broken, not necessarily things are bad for everyone everywhere, or here's this systemic injustice, or if it is a systemic injustice, it's this is how it affects me, right? It's my kind of individual struggle with it. Or if things are going well, right, then it's still things are going well for me, which just by definition is going to lead away from political music. So I don't know that we should get to it this time, but next time, if we talk about communism, there, country music does not get into the communist, the red struggle that much. Right? I have not been able to find a country music singer who was brought in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee for or against, you know, positive or for or against communism. They may be out there, but I haven't found one yet. And I mean, they interviewed everybody, right? I mean, Walt Disney, for crying out loud, was in front of the committee, and John Wayne. And so, and I only found one song that was explicitly sort of early Cold War-ish, but I'll save that for next time. Anything else about this sort of early 50s or Hank Williams? I mean, we probably haven't done him justice. Favorite Hank Williams song, what do you guys got?
Oh, gosh. I already said it. I think "I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry" is it. So I think that's for me.
I heard that "Lonesome Whistle" is really great, but I like the upbeat songs. I've been listening a lot to "Dear John" this week, which that song is brutal. Yeah. I mean, it's played for laughs. It's kind of a novelty song, but his wife leaves him and says the advice she gives him is, if you're feeling blue, cry. You know what I mean? Like, that's pretty rough. And then she goes, steals all his money. I also have a real soft spot for Jambalaya on the Bayou.
Mm. That's a good one.
Although I think we can all agree the best one, Kalaja.
You know, I know that as a Charlie Pride song first.
He covered it, yeah.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's a great song, Lost, but, yeah.
Lost Highway is a song, I mean, I don't think it's original to him. Did he write that? I don't know.
I don't think he did write it, but his version is haunting.
It is. It's an amazing song, and it's sort of, that's a song that typifies not only kind of country music in the way that we're kind of defining it, but also like rock music as well. And so that's a song that's kind of eminently coverable by lots of people, and his version is still probably the most effective. And so, yeah, that is an unbelievable
song. I'm with you, Danny, on I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry as the best of his songs. And when we get closer to the end of this, I want to ask, what is the greatest country music song? I think it's got like a serious shot at that title.
It's top 20 for sure. I mean, if not,
oh, yeah,
top 10.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So we'll leave it there with this very scattered episode. Listener, for future episodes, as we get farther into a more definitive genre, we'll have a little tighter format, and I'll do a better job of writing an outline. So sorry on that one, guys. Anything you folks wanted to add about World War II or late 1940s or the first year or two of 1950 on country music? Otherwise, we'll leave it there and pick up next time.
I think Michael was right about the kind of special place that honky tonk plays in kind of defining, sure, country music. I mean, when people think of classic country, I think he's right that it is sort of honky tonk that you're thinking of, because I think that is a setting that is really important to the themes that country music does best, where these kind of desperation, you know, and poverty and tragedy. And so locating the music's, you know, playing in a place where people are dealing with problems like a honky tonk are, I think, is entirely appropriate. So for me, we're
dealing with problems is a great euphemism for what goes on in a honky tonk.
Yeah, let's call it that. Yeah. But yeah, no, I think that Hank Williams, as kind of the preeminent honky tonk artist, I think this is a great place to sort of kind of introduce that as a really important location.
To do something that maybe we should have done a little more of at the beginning. When you guys say classic country music, again, I start to think 1950s and 1960s. And clearly you guys are wanting to push that back earlier.
No, I agree.
When you say honky-tonk, again, this will show my age. I immediately go to Dwight Yoakam.
Dwight Yoakam is reviving that style. So I was going to say that earlier. Dwight Yoakam is a really good modern exemplar of honky tonk music.
And I think Dwight Yoakam, because in the opening scenes of Terminator 2, when he goes into the honky tonk to get clothes and clothes, boots, and motorcycle or whatever it is, right? Dwight Yoakam is playing in the background. So
that's right. Dwight Yoakam is my favorite country singer, and so I totally can't wait till we get to the 80s. So
I do think we should say just a word about Lefty Frizzell, who is the closest thing Hank Williams has to a competitor in terms of classic honky tonk music. Lefty Frizzell is probably best known for the song "If You've Got the Money, I've Got the Time," which is a wonderful song, and he's got five or six that are that good. "My Baby's Just Like Money," "Always Late with Your Kisses," "More, More, More." He's a great singer. There would be no Merle Haggard if there were no Lefty Frizzell, for sure. Merle Haggard is doing a Lefty Frizzell impression.
Yeah. And Willie Nelson actually has a whole album called From Willie to Lefty. It's a whole album of just covers of Lefty Frizzell songs. It's an amazing body of work when you think about the you don't necessarily remember his recordings of those songs, but he is also like right up there as a giant of this genre for sure.
Much less successful than Williams at the time.
Yeah.
Let's see, when did Hank Williams die again? 53. So Lefty Frizzell starts off ahead of Williams, but Williams catches up. So in 51 of the 10 slots on the Billboard country charts, Lefty Frizzell had four of them.
Well, I guess I'm wrong about him not being successful.
Well, no. But Williams catches up. Like that's also when Williams sort of gets on the scene, and he rockets past him. But Frizzell was kind of ahead of the ahead of him a little bit because his career started sooner. I mean, he's younger and was on the scene earlier.
But you can't count on people knowing Lefty Frizzell like you can count on them knowing right. Hank Williams. And if you haven't listened to him, go listen to him. He's great.
Yeah. Some legal ickiness, but, you know, we'll get into that maybe. Maybe we'll devote a whole show to country music legal ickiness.
I'm not a Lefty Frizzell fan, so I will admit that he is important and he is technically good, but I don't like him.
Fair enough.
Well, anything else? Otherwise, we should bring this to an end.
No, this was great. I always learn a lot from you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you guys once again for joining us, and thank you, listener, for tuning in. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please do check out the other podcasts in the family and get more information about our own show at christianhumanist.org. Also, leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show. I know Danny Anderson on Sectarian Review promised to read those, right? When people leave reviews.
I do them. Yeah, I do read them.
I don't promise to do that. So, you know, that's time that I could be talking about me. Although I'm always tempted to read the negative ones and then to mock them, but I haven't brought myself to do that yet either.
I don't even look, because if any of them are negative, I couldn't deal with
it. Oh, yeah.
I'm a very, very fragile self.
I'm arrogant enough that I just assume there's something wrong with them. When I ran for city collector, I had 11 people who did not vote for me. It doesn't mean they voted against me. They just didn't vote for me. And there's 11.
You tracked each one of them down.
Yeah, like there's 11 people who just need some correction in Bolivar. Anyway,
you're actually going to collect taxes from them.
if there were a tax, I would be the one to collect it. Also, like our face.
I just pictured that scene from Robin Hood where the sheriff of Nottingham steals all the money from the baby rabbit.
And pounds the money out of the guy's cast. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, little woman.
What can I do? My hands are tied. Leave us a note on Facebook. Drop us a note on Facebook at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or shoot us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Edward Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's.
This is the last gamble song. The end of 100-year wars. The voices sound sad as they're singing along. Another piece of America's lost.